Rob Wolf, Andy Dees, what's up, brother?
Dude, folks need to know that Andy had a near-death experience yesterday at the hands of Kelly Starrett.
I think actually it was 2 days ago.
Oh, 2 days ago,
unfortunately,
okay.
And I'm still wrecked. But you know, Rob, you know, I drive down to across to San Francisco, get a little PT work done on my hip, low back, but only in Kelly Starrett's world do I show up an hour early just to hang out. And he's like, okay, max deadlifts with bands. Let's see what you got. And I'm like, well, I'm here to work on my hip. Oh, he's like, oh, yeah, we're going to work on your hip. Let's see how it's doing. So, you know, then I proceed to deadlift heavy. Then I have to do some squat finishers. And then he's like, okay, I see what I need to see. Let's work on your hip. And I'm like, meanwhile, already crushed prior to him, you know, tearing my hip capsules apart.
It sounds like a party. And you drove like 7 hours round trip to do it. So sounds awesome.
But I did get to have him stand on me for about a half hour, stand on my IT bands, which was one of the more pleasurable moments of my adult life. So I feel like as long as I've affected some change, it was totally worth it.
Yeah, if you haven't had Kelly work on you, it's definitely exercise and torture that you need to try. I was actively trying to both poop and pee my pants to get him to stop reefing on my hips because he had me face down doing some sort of like a piriformis mobilization with basically the full amount of his weight on my person. And I really was trying to like foul myself just so he would leave me alone, and I couldn't do it. I was in so much pain I couldn't like disengage my bladder. So
yeah,
it's great stuff.
And the cherry was he called me that night and he said, I just want to be honest with you, is that you have the worst hips I've ever worked on, so just so we're clear. And I've never inflicted that much damage on one person. He's like, so I don't believe in ibuprofen, but I would encourage you to use it heavily this evening because I'm not sure how much inflammation you're going to have in your system when you wake up tomorrow.
And oh, by the way, did you sign a waiver before you left? <I don't>.
And final note, Andy, please squat heavy tomorrow. We need to use that new range. I'm like,
yeah.
Amen.
Keep the range.
That's right. So with more range comes more responsibility. But yeah, that's sort of, you know, that's my week, Rob. I'm wrecked. But I don't get any cool drugs or anything fun like you.
Well, you know, surgery is one step up, brother. So
fair. That's entirely fair. Anything else going on you need to share with the listeners today?
Making some good headway on the book, writing the lifestyle kind of cortisol chapter right now, and just the end is in sight, so just chugging along.
I also noticed there was a rumor on the blog comment that we actually might be getting a DVD copy of Rad.
Yeah, apparently Nick is shipping us a copy of Rad, so we'll do a prisoner exchange. I'll take a copy of Rad and ship him some t-shirts.
Nice.
Some of them now contraband, some of them still legit. So, yeah.
But always fun to wear.
Always fun to wear. Yeah,
right.
Conversation piece in each t-shirt for sure.
That's right. Maybe you can wipe out any CrossFit NorCal stuff like Dallas did on his shirts.
I'll leave that up to Nick to do. He can
protect the brand name, brother.
That's right.
All right. Well, episode 16, we got a group of questions, and you know, I think there's some good ones in here. I'm excited to see you spin around in a circle on a couple of these. So,
I think I get a sense of when you're in a feisty mood by the type of questions you pick. So.
You can tell where my day's going already. You're like,
yeah,
it's 3 o'clock. Andy's a wreck. He's feisty. It's going to be a good day.
It's going to be a good day. Yeah.
All right, cool. Well, the first question is from Pat. Rob, can you comment on biosignature? How is that different than metabolic typing from a pseudoscience point of view? It has been a while since you attended the BioSig seminar. How has it impacted your clinical practice? Thanks.
From a pseudoscience point of view, I guess from that standpoint is that the biosignature actually works, and the metabolic typing to the best of my ability to try to apply any type of consistency to it really doesn't. And therefore, it's obviously pseudoscience, similar to the paleo concept versus the zone concept, putting paleo obviously squarely in the pseudoscience camp because it actually works well and has some universal transfer. You know, the metabolic typing is really interesting but it just has never borne any fruit for me at all, and it seems to involve a ton of diagnostic measures followed up by a ton of supplements, and it, we'll get to the supplements with regards to the BioSig because there is some supplementation side to that, but I just don't find the metabolic typing doing all that much for me, and it's still, as like a universal baseline, it ends up recommending various types of like grains, legumes, dairy to everybody, which I think is just frankly kind of retarded. And especially in light of the fact that when we pull those things out of the diet for people, that they end up just kind of universally getting better, you know, they look, feel, perform better, that whole thing. So the metabolic typing, I've just never, again, never seen much traction with it. Have seen some folks like the Eads and some other people play with that. They played with the blood type diet in their clinical practice, and it was just like, dude, the, you know, we would get more mileage out of astrology than this stuff. It was kind of what they came down to. So that's cool, kind of where that stuff lies out. Now, the BioSignature, even though some prominent coaches have been highly critical of Charles Poliquin for the BioSignature stuff, less do they know that this thing has actually the way that this whole thing came together was that there were some observations long time ago that body fat distributions can be somewhat correlative with some things like insulin resistance or insulin sensitivity, you know, that impending metabolic arrangement usually could be associated with storing fat above the waistline, you know, versus like a what we would call an apple type fat distribution versus a pear type fat distribution, which is storing more of the fat below the waistline and whatnot. And then I forget exactly how Charles started investigating this stuff, but they started looking at the body, the thicknesses, skin fold thicknesses, body fat thicknesses at various sites around the body, and then started looking at the endocrine profiles of these people. Did they have high testosterone levels or low testosterone levels? Did they have, you know, high insulin levels or low insulin levels, high estrogen, low estrogen, et cetera, et cetera? And they started doing these correlative studies. And he's done quite a bit of work with some universities, I think some in Sweden, some in Toronto. I forget exactly what it is, but there have been several thousand people that have been looked at with this information, and it's correlation. It's, you know, what do the body fat measures correlate to? And as people should keep in mind, correlation is not causation. But the BioSignature, when you are adept at taking a good body fat measurement via the BioSignature protocol, and then you stick those body fat measurements into the software that Charles has developed and has continued to basically increase the population of people that the correlations have been inputted in there. He's even getting some distinctions with regard to geographical location and ethnicity and some stuff like that. He's seen a few variabilities within some different ethnic groups and geographic groups and whatnot. But basically, this thing has grown and developed, and the BioSignature, when somebody learns how to do it well, can give you some pretty interesting insights into what the hormonal profile of an individual is. Like when I went to it, Scotty Hagness and I went, and interesting story, this is actually where Andy and I, well, we had met before at a really early CrossFit cert, but Andy found out that Scotty and I were going to be in Scottsdale area for like a week doing the Charles Poliquin BioSignature gig, and Andy shot me an email and said, hey, dude, you and Scotty are welcome to stay with me and my wife for the duration that you were there. And Rachel was horrified at that prospect, but everything ended up, I guess, working out okay. You guys have moved to Chico, and she doesn't hate us too badly for that, so that's all good, but kind of interesting tie around to that. But, you know, the BioSignature course ended up involving a ton of information regarding basic endocrinology, nutrition, paleo diet. Like, there's really a ton of information in there, but then a bunch of hands-on work trying to get that manual dexterity to be able to do consistent, replicatable body fat tests, because the touch is very, very just labor intensive. You have to put a lot of time into developing that hand-eye coordination. and get the right feel for people. Different people have very, very different types of skin and different types of fat, and some of that is kind of indicative of what they have going on also. When I was going through that whole thing, it was at, I wouldn't say the tail end, but maybe three quarters through my efforts on the mass gain front, and I was fat. I was pretty darn chunky, definitely fatter than I had been in a long, long time. And when Charles would do my, I volunteered a bunch because I really wanted to find out what was going on with me, and I had the metabolic profile of somebody who was like, you know, 12 pack a day Twinkie sort of deal. Like I was going after the metabolic or what's the molecularly baked goods, like, you know, or something like that. I was kind of a mess, and Charles' recommendation or his analysis was that I had sky high cortisol levels and really, really shitty insulin sensitivity, on the normal but probably low side of testosterone, and his recommendation was a low-carb diet, no stress, and get leaned out and get my metabolic functioning kind of squared away, which instead of listening to Charles' good advice, I took his I came out with this kind of dual, what they would call a protocol or issue of both cortisol issues and insulin issues. And as we've learned more and more and more, these two things go hand in glove, and sometimes it's hard to figure out which one is causing what. But given the fact that even though I was doing a mass gain-ish deal and I was eating a lot of food, it was generally pretty low carb. I was doing a lot of dairy, but probably my biggest issue was a cortisol thing, but I definitely had some insulin resistance. So Charles has various protocols that grows out of the, you know, your biosignature. For me, it related to management of cortisol and management of insulin, and both of these things involved consistent feeding schedule, low carb, some phosphatidylserine for the cortisol management issue. Tweaking of my training so that I was causing less stress, like I was going to the ATM and actually making deposits, and, you know, to myself instead of always taking away, which the metabolic conditioning was doing at that time. And instead of doing all that stuff, I just tried hammering the cortisol management protocol and the insulin management protocol with a bunch more food and a bunch more dairy, and it just didn't work. And that was part of the when I did a review of the whole thing. I did that for about 2.5 or 3 months. I started doing some biosignature on our clients, and I liked it. But like when Ido and even James Fitzgerald suggested that I go do the biosignature, they said it's not really going to change about 90% of what you're doing. You know, it's still going to boil down to like a low carb, gluten free kind of paleo diet for most people, and then appropriately tailoring lifestyle and post-workout nutrition to fit various needs and all that sort of stuff. And so there was kind of that element of it, and then there was also the element that for me, I really tackled it in a way that was contrary to the advice that I was given, hoping that I could just kind of supersede my own genetics and my own kind of metabolic situation and still get big and burly, and it didn't work. But I also did not follow the advice of the practitioner whom I had paid to tell me what to do. And so, you know, it's my original analysis of the whole thing. I really need to add a caveat and go back and either do an update or something and just kind of add in there that I really wasn't following the protocol the way that I had been told to do. And over time, I've seen this stuff become more and more beneficial from kind of a diagnostic standpoint to reaffirm what people have going on. Frequently looking at them, like 9/10 of people that you deal with, they're going to have insulin and cortisol issues. Some females are going to end up with some high estrogen type things, and there's some estrogen management protocols that you can do. But that's really kind of like 80% of the stuff that you're going to see, and the management isn't that far afield from what we normally recommend each day, but it's really good validating information for people. I tend to minimize that type of stuff. I tend to minimize like body fat tracking in general. I had historically minimized things like before and after photos, and all of that has been to my detriment and to our client's detriment. Like each layer of tracking that we have introduced, our clients have done better and people are happier. They like that quantification, even if we're charging them for it. And so that's just been a slow learning process for me, and I would say probably a pretty significant mistake that I made as a coach, not emphasizing more of that quantification early on to help give people anchors and standards to see, yeah, no, not only do I look, feel, and perform better, but we're seeing some positive vectors on photographs, on body fat measurements, and on this overall biosignature kind of thing. So at that time, though, and if you sniff around my former employer's commentary on Charles Poliquin, though, you'll notice that Poliquin is a reviled figure. So I definitely did not have, let's say, administrative support in my attendance at that seminar. It was actually a pretty controversial topic. And so I think part of my desire to kind of jettison that information was to try to make good with that scene. So again, to my discredit in some ways, but that's more of the full story on it. But Scotty Hagness has been going great guns with the biosignature. He's after he does the Putting It All Together seminar there at Catalyst Athletics, he's heading down and doing, I think, a Poliquin level one, level two training seminar also. So he's really getting in deep with that stuff, and it's really helped him, really helped his clients a lot.
First of all, I want to comment that was an incredibly long answer, so well done. We're already at 17 minutes.
Ease Louise, wow.
But I think it was good. I'm glad you touched on some of the, I think for some folks, biosig is kind of a new topic, depending on what side of the fence you sit on. And I'm still waiting for the Rob Wolf update. I was interested if you were going to touch on the famous Charles Poliquin post. So I will put a little note. For Rob Wolf.
I should do an update on that and kind of give the full backstory with where I was at, on a variety of levels and kind of some funny stories behind it. And also what I've seen now, more than a year down the road with Scotty continuing to use it. We use it at NorCal in a limited fashion. I'm just not home all that much, and I'm kind of the only person that's savvy with it right now. We're hoping to have Scotty come up and get some of the trainers more adept at just the body fat measure, so we can at least do that chunk and take that measure for our clients, and then we can do the analysis later. But yeah, there's some important stuff. And so, if people want to follow this up, they could obviously go and do the biosignature directly, which I highly, highly recommend. James Fitzgerald has his take on this stuff also, which he has woven into his OPT training seminars, and you get some exposure to that in addition to his take on the nutrition and the overall programming and all that. Those are two, areas of personal development that I just couldn't recommend enough. Tackling either or both of those would be just absolutely amazing, both on just like an informational level, but these are both people that have run very, very successful gyms and have trained thousands of people. It's just both James and Charles have some thousands and thousands of hours of experience that if you really want to take yourself seriously as a coach, you can really bypass a lot of mistakes by going and kind of sitting at the feet of these people and learning some stuff. I know I learn a ton every time I hang out with either one of those people. So,
sure. All right. Good answer.
Cool. Andy's like, okay, dude, move on.
Your poor wife's probably home listening to you today. So,
she never listens to me. So.
She's just like,
you have a podcast, really? Oh yeah, you have like six listeners.
It's like the Charlie Brown voice. Huh? She's like, I don't even hear what he's saying anymore.
Totally, and that's on the best of days. So,
all right, cool. Next question from Ian. He says, "Hey Rob, I've been having to do PT every morning for the Fire Academy 5 days a week for about an hour and a half. Lots of slow jogging." Parentheses, yuck, close parentheses, his comment. Push-ups, pull-ups, band work, sit-ups, etc., all for higher reps, 25 to 100. I've been doing two strength workouts on my own at night, usually doing one or two lifts each session, eating paleo with one cheat meal per week, and getting 8 to 8.5 hours of sleep per night. My questions are, one, should I drop the Metcons after my strength session, as they are short, like 10 to 12 minutes, and... two, in your opinion, is this a case where I should maybe play with some sweet potatoes yams post-WOD, even if the goal is to lean out a bit? Been hitting about 15 grams BCAAs, 10 grams glutamine, 5 grams creatine post-workout, but feel like I'm depleting my glycogen stores pretty good with the high rep work.
I guess the only thing that's kind of missing here is more specifics on what Ian actually wants to accomplish. I'm assuming that he's just kind of wanting to maintain consistency at the PT for the Fire Academy. I'm just not super sure where.
I guess let's kind of look at it a different way. So if he has to do PT every day for the Fire Academy, which, holy cow, that's a lot of PT, I'd probably die. So his first question is, I think it appears he's doing some extra Metcon stuff.
Right.
After his strength circuit, or his strength workouts that he's doing on his own at night in addition to his morning work. Do we think that he should keep that in there or remove it?
It really depended on his goals. Like if he's just, you know, wanting to get by at the PT element of the Fire Academy and wants to say get bigger or get stronger, then I think he could ditch those. And then also, like, it's just a little bit telling that folks are like 10 to 12 minute Metcons are short, which they're on the shorter end, but, you know, you can certainly time index that to half that level and still get a nice little dose out of it too. So there's a couple of, it really depends on what Ian's goals are here. You know, if he wants to get bigger, wants to get stronger, I would probably curtail that extra Metcon either altogether, or I would make it shorter duration to accentuate the growth. Here again, like everybody's on the lean out a bit kind of gig, it really depends. Like some people lean out fine on a protocol in which they stick the bulk of their carbs post workout, and then they're otherwise doing a good amount of training. Some people don't. Like it really again kind of depends on what type of goals are there, and then how he responds to carbs, like how carb tolerant he is. I like the branched chain amino acids. The glutamine is legit. Creatine's all legit. But it just kind of depends a little bit on what Ian wants to pull out of this stuff.
I'm just shocked at 8 hours of PT. But
definitely a lot of time to burn there. It's definitely a physical job. So
For sure. I
guess good to lay that baseline. But you could get a lot done in an hour and a half a day. That's for sure.
Seriously. All right, cool. Well, if we, Ian, if you want to shoot a follow-up about specific goals, maybe we can loop back around.
I think Ian, you know, he asks questions, but it always, if you can lay in a little bit more specifics to what the end goal might be, it just makes it a lot easier to narrow down. Like just looking at this from the big picture, we could see a potential performance orientation, in which case I would say potentially the post-workout carbs are a great idea. We could have a leaning potential as the main focus, you know, kind of an aesthetics focus, in which case we're just going to have to look at how much carbs Ian is doing and then kind of titrate from there. And it'll range anywhere from quite a bit and maybe focusing on post-workout to almost none and not really having him in the mix at all, depending on what his metabolic, you know, kind of handling of insulin is. And then if he wants to get big, then I would drop the Metcons and, you know, bigger, stronger. I would shorten the Metcons even more potentially and possibly drop them altogether.
Yep. All right. Good. Next question from Cheryl. She says, you've touched on the effects of paleo on insulin-dependent diabetics. How about a few minutes for non-insulin-dependent diabetics? I'm curious as to how the insulin response will show up in this population with a strict paleo, modified paleo, meaning strategic inclusion of legumes and dairy, especially since many have excess insulin that just isn't doing its job. Thanks. And then she also says, enjoyed listening to you and Andy. Maybe one day you'll move your cast to Blog Talk Radio and take live questions. My Lord, Rob. I fear Rob Wolf on a live podcast.
I don't know. How much worse could it get?
That might be true.
I don't know. I'd be game for that. That might be fun. I don't know if very many folks would. You know, the deal with that, and I guess you could always have some questions in queue in case we had, like, crickets chirping in the background. But we give that a shot. So, Stefan Lindberg, if you just punch into Google Catawba study, then you'll get Lindbergh's site. And he did two really interesting studies. He studied the Katavans in detail over the last like 20 or 30 years. He's an MD PhD in Sweden. He did a paleo diet that was analyzed in swine, in pigs, which interestingly, I was actually one of the review editors for that at the Journal of Nutrition and Metabolism. And then that one showed a very favorable blood glucose response with pigs, and then they put it into humans, and they compared a paleo diet, grain-free, dairy-free, legume-free paleo diet in type 2 diabetics, and they had a grain, legume, low-fat, dairy, Mediterranean diet in type 2 diabetics, and these two groups were compared side by side. I think it was an 8-week protocol, 6 week, I forget what it was, but at the end of the 8-week protocol, whatever the timeline was on the protocol, I forget the duration, the paleo diet folks, now these were ad libitum, these folks were allowed to eat to satiety. It was not particularly low carb. These people ate yams, sweet potatoes, fruits, vegetables, lean meats, nuts and seeds, blah, 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 all that stuff, but it was paleo oriented. But that group, the paleo group, was no longer technically type 2 diabetic. They had normal fasting blood glucose levels. They had normal insulin response to glucose. Interestingly, they only had a little bit of a change in their waist circumference, which I don't know if a longer period of time we would see improvements in that measure. But we definitely appeared on a metabolic level to see improved insulin sensitivity and not so in the highly vaunted Mediterranean diet group. So this is where I would ask Cheryl, exactly what strategic inclusion of legumes and dairy would you use other than to fuck people up at this point? Because it's very clear that the lectin issue in these foods is probably one of the main causative factors in the whole leptin dysregulation that leads into insulin dysregulation. Like there is no strategic use here other than make people insulin resistant is kind of one thing. And then the other part to that is that, I don't know if I want to launch into that. Andy, do you have any thoughts on that chunk? I'll try to not get too verbose on this thing right now. What are your thoughts on that?
No, I thought it was good. That's part of the reason I put this one in here is I wanted to hear your thoughts on the strategic inclusion of legumes. And legumes. And, we've talked about the dairy thing. I think it beat it to death.
And that's not trying not to be a jerk about this thing, but it's very, very – this is a really well-done study and a very, very compelling study in that we have this just highly vaunted like Mediterranean diet. It's whole grains. It's legumes. It's – low glycemic load, blah, blah, blah. But we have Neolithic foods, and these people at the end of this run are as insulin resistant as when they were at the beginning. And then the people who removed the Neolithic foods did not even have the benefit. Like I would argue that they would have had even better success had they done a low-carb paleo diet at this point, because not only are they metabolically deranged from some sort of quasi-autoimmune issue that's being caused by the lectins in grains, legumes, dairy. But just the quickest way to reset that insulin sensitivity is to just drop basal insulin levels overall. And that, you know, probably the best way to do that is reducing carbohydrate level and then maybe not eating six times a day, you know, breakfast, lunch, dinner, a little bit of a compressed feeding window, a la a little bit of intermittent fasting is probably like the fastest way to reset insulin levels in that case. Nice. And you know, like I hope we keep reminding people, type 2 diabetes, everything related to that, it is an environmental disease. It is a disease of your environment. You are exposing yourself to elevated carbohydrate intake in general. But we're also kind of discovering, because of the pesky Katavans and all that, that there's also a subcategory to this that it's, you know, really is the type of carbohydrate that we're dealing with. Now, there's caveats to that, because there's obviously situations in which people want to lean out more, want better metabolic control, and they need to really be careful with even the amount of fruit and like yams and sweet potatoes that they take in. But I wonder sometimes too if that problem, like, would I be more insulin sensitive if I did absolutely no traveling and I was never exposed to gluten? Like, is part of my insulin resistance my inability to handle carbohydrates better? Is that due in part to the fact that, like, every single time I travel, I get some sort of a gluten dose? Or, like, when I eat out, I get some sort of a gluten dose frequently. And because I am more sensitive to all that stuff, is that causing some leptin resistance that's then making me insulin resistant? If I lived on a desert island with literally only, like, taro root, coconut, and fish to eat, could I eat a ton of carbohydrate, like, you know, upwards of 60% of carbs, like the Katavan Sioux, and be lean and muscular and healthy? I don't know. I'll give that a shot.
Only if you had some wild boar in there.
I'll throw some wild boar in there. Yeah.
All right. Good question.
Yep. Totally. Really, really good question. And apologies if I get overly feisty about that, but just really important that folks keep that stuff in mind.
Next, we got a question from Sot. Hi, I am in Australia. Wanted to thank Rob for all the info he passes out. It's awesome and helped me a lot with my health and fitness. Question on green drinks. I use Core Greens from Synergy. Am I wasting my time and money adding it to water? Core Drinks has no algae in it. Ingredients are clean from what I can tell.
You know, I'm okay with most green drinks. You make sure that they don't have like I go back and forth on like the wheat and barley grass. Like I don't, mm-hmm. Those things typically don't have any type of gluten in them, but depending on when that stuff was extracted in the germination cycle, they can. So, and even Polican, if you have some sort of, if you're on a cortisol protocol, he will have you take a green drink that is 100% grain-free, and he tends to recommend grain-free green drinks for like the kind of alkalinizing element. And so he's pretty good at recommending a non kind of sprouted grain legume sort of gig for his green drink. So if you can find something that looks like that, I would generally try to take it with a little bit of food. I think your absorption on like an empty stomach is probably going to be low because a bunch of that stuff, the all the carotenoids, the astaxanthin, zeaxanthin, carotenes and all that, they really absorb better with some fat. So I think shooting it down with a meal would probably be better than not. That would be my only caveats with that. And then obviously, assuming that this thing isn't a sugary kind of concoction.
Yeah, the ingredients look good. And I don't know. I mean, I've played with the green drinks off and on, Greens Plus, et cetera, a la Berardi, and I never noticed a difference with it. But, you know, that's just my...
Yeah, I think it's one of those kind of, you know, subtle... If they do you any good at all, it's probably subtle. But I think some... freeze-dried powdered veggies is probably not the worst thing in the world. When I start seeing people juicing like 15 pounds of broccoli and a bunch of apples and everything, then we've kind of got some problems. But again, it's because of the carbohydrate load. You know, right. Most of these powdered green drinks are really almost kind of not a one-to-one. They're kind of a one-to-one with regards to the amount of carbohydrate they contain, typically. So,
all right, good. Yeah. Next question from Eli. Rob, appreciate all the time you take with the podcast. They are top notch and learning a lot from them. My question is twofold. First, my wife had a baby 6 months ago. Congratulations. She's trying to shed some of the baby weight and was thinking that a paleo approach might help. She has a fairly active lifestyle, but is not much for doing structured, regimented workouts. I was not sure if you've ever worked with post-baby moms, but was looking for your input. She is still nursing, and I'm sure she would be concerned with the diet hurting her milk production. So let's just start there.
Chrissy, who... one of our trainers, my wife's sister, she just had, she has a 17-month-old. She put in a little note here, Chrissy's feedback. Just in case you wanted my opinion, if she eats enough food, milk production should be fine as far as the baby goes. Our pediatrician told us, and I guess that's part of, you know, leads into the part two. We've worked with tons and tons and tons of women who became moms and then, you know, hatched the kids, became pregnant, then became moms. The moms do great on paleo. The kids do great on paleo. The digestion with the kids is phenomenal. They do great. They're way happier. I mean, it's just a really good scene, and it's just a simple thing to play with and experiment. Like, give it a shot yourself and kind of see how all this stuff goes. So Should have no problem with milk production, any of that stuff on a paleo shtick.
I want to point out my favorite part of the question is that she wants to shed some of the baby weight, and I was thinking that a paleo approach might help. Paleo approach helps everything, Rob. What podcast do you think this is? No, I'm just kidding.
It helps everything except the rice and corn growers, apparently.
For sure on that one. All right. Second part of the question has to do with our daughter. She's starting to eat some baby food and was wondering what advice you could give a parent who wants to start his daughter off right when it comes to developing good food habits early. I think it'd be easier to steer her in the right direction from the start than to try to break bad habits later. I see people whose kids are already addicted to fast food garbage and sweets and definitely do not want to start that trend. However, I know that a baby is limited in what food they're actually allowed to consume at these early stages of life. Thanks in advance for any advice that you might have.
And there again, like Chrissy's feedback on that, her pediatrician recommended just basically introducing foods when the kids start looking interested. Like they'll start looking around at the food you're eating and look a little, you know, they're kind of reaching for it and stuff like that. And you puree the food. You start with like yellow fruits and vegetables, sweet potatoes, apples, etc., meat, chicken. You puree it, get into a paste, dab it in their mouth, see if they like it. They will like certain things and not like other things. The stuff that they don't like, you can try it again in like a month or two because their taste buds do change, and things that they didn't like previously they may like in the future. And they, again, like they just do really, really well. Caden and like a ton of the kids in the gym now, they haven't really had the cereals, and they don't have any of the colic or the digestive issues that the other kids tend to have. And I don't know why the kid issue becomes such an incendiary, like hot button, you know, topic. But all I'm recommending is that you give it a shot. You know, it kind of boils down to like, if you just ran 1,000 calories of fruits, vegetables, and lean meats through a nutrition analyzer and looked at how much vitamins, minerals, and antioxidants there were versus grains, legumes, and dairy, the grains, legumes, and dairy don't even meet the RDA. They don't even meet like the bare minimum. Whereas like the fruits, vegetables, lean meats, seafood, etc., that ends up looking like a nutritional supplement. So is it better or worse to feed your child more or less nutritionally dense foods? And then when you start looking at it from that standpoint, the whole question starts becoming a little bit silly, other than the fact that these are our staple foods and what our government tells us to eat and all that sort of stuff. So, I mean, it is a little bit different in that regard.
Yeah, you know what? On that topic, I think I'm going to post a link to the famous Rob Wolf NorCal post, Are We Crazy?
Yeah, it's a goodie. A goodie. Yeah.
That's good. I like that one. I'll include that in this because I think that's the whole nutritional analyzer thing, I think, is a good mm-hmm. perspective. All right, good. Question from Chandler. Hey, Rob, hopefully this isn't going outside your purview. I don't think that would stop Rob from answering. So, recently you mentioned the immune response to gluten in the gut in comparison to the immune response to poison oak on the skin. Moreover, that it's an immune reaction that causes the inflammation. You've also related stories of people who, after having been gluten-free for a period of time, get into intestinal trouble upon eating wheat. As such, I would assume that children generally go through the same wheat induction as they're introduced to food. Is this true, and are you aware of any information on the subject? If it's not true, how do you explain the discrepancy?
Yeah, I would generally say that's true, and this is generally like all the gut rot kind of GI problems that we see in kids when we start introducing cereals to them. And most people end up recognizing that like corn or rice-based cereal end up being less problematic than wheat-based cereal, but they still, again, just like very simple kind of gig, as compared to feeding kids fruit, vegetables, yams, sweet potatoes, the even like corn cereal ends up causing significant kind of GI problems in the kids. And it's a pretty simple thing to just tinker with and see for yourself. So yeah, I mean, there's no discrepancy there. It's pretty consistent gig.
All right. Second unrelated question from the poison oak comparison. How do you categorize spicy foods like chili peppers? From reading the Wikipedia page on capsaicin?
Capsaicin.
Capsaicin. See, yeah. That's why you're the biochemist. It appears that the chemical excites nerve cells without tissue damage, i.e. the experienced pain isn't a result of an allergic reaction. However, I'm curious to get your take on these types of foods.
Oh, we should drag Garrett Smith in here for sure. his chunk on this. You know, the chili peppers, they're gut irritants. I mean, this is actually an analogy that I use with the gluten itself, but then also using actually chili peppers specifically. What happens to your nose and mouth when you eat really hot food? It starts, you know, your nose runs, your mouth, you know, saliva production increases. So it's an irritant, it registers as an irritant, and then your body tries to dilute that irritant by producing a bunch of snot and mucus and just basically trying to move it through. And although it's not an allergic reaction, capsaicin can, in sufficient amounts, be what's called an excitotoxin, in which it actually kills nerve endings. So you can damage nerve endings to nerves to the point of actual like cellular death from capsaicin. It's pretty damn hard to do, but you can do it. And it definitely is one of those vectors of a GI irritation. Now, this is, for me, a big problem because I love tomatoes, love curries, all that sort of stuff. So I still eat these foods. I don't seem to really notice that much problem with them. Some other people do. I remember Coach Bergner, before he had his knee replacement, really noticed a big difference by removing nightshades out of his diet. Different people have kind of reported various degrees of problem with the nightshades. But yeah, it's and nightshades being like tomatoes, potatoes, eggplants, and then like all these chili pepper type things, ranging from bell peppers to like serrano chilies and stuff like that.
Yeah, and I think if you just Google nightshades, there's a ton of interesting stuff out there.
Yeah, yeah, and some folks like Garrett Smith, he would stick the nightshades as bad as gluten, and I don't doubt that there are probably people who have the susceptibility markers to be bad in that regard. It was interesting when we kind of discovered the sorghum-based beer, the Red Bridge. I do fine on it and can drink a couple of those. And, you know, it's not really any different than just generally drinking booze. You know, it usually makes my sleep a little bit less good and all that sort of stuff, but really not that big a deal depending on how much I take in. But then Dutch Lowy, he doesn't do well with gluten, you know, as a baseline. But when he tried the Red Bridge, the sorghum beer, it ruined him. Whereas, like, he can have kind of a thinner beer, like a Budweiser or a Corona or something, which theoretically has some gluten in it, and it bothers him less than the sorghum-based beer does. And so that, you know, that's that thing again. All grains contain lectins. Different people have different susceptibilities to different things, and so you just kind of have to keep that in the back of your head. And so it wouldn't be surprising that there's probably different susceptibilities to the nightshades. And again, the people that I would recommend probably looking at this stuff are people with kind of known inflammatory problems or autoimmune problems. Like, you're probably going to want to aggressively remove these out of your diet and see if you feel better. Otherwise, curry is just too damn good to forego it. So,
well, I think the last time I talked to Garrett about it too, when he had done some of my cortisol stuff, his comment, I think, for a lot of folks was, you know, similar. Take that stuff out for 30 days, add it back in, kind of see what happens.
Yeah, that elimination diet is just money. You know, it's really, really solid, especially if you do a very comprehensive approach to it.
Rob Wolf Elimination Diet,
$9.99. I should just try selling. I really should make a PDF and just stick a price tag on it. And it's like, cut out these foods. Do it for a month.
Rob, I'm telling you, what's this guy's name? Dax Malloy in Europe. He sells the elimination diet package. I'm telling you.
Dude, I should do it. We will have jumped the shark at that point. Right on the heels of that, we'll start selling molecularly baked goods also. But
nice. I'll be so happy to eat some of those.
Yeah.
All right. I think we're gonna do maybe one more because I gotta train some folks. Okay. Question from Daniel. Hi, Rob. Daniel from Sydney, Australia. A TV show called Food Investigators on SBS airs over here did a paleo diet trial and had good results. However, the man in the experiment lost the same amount of muscle mass as he did fat, and I was hoping you may have an idea as to why this happened.
You know, I if you go to that website, which we actually have the website in the PDF, I was like the second person to comment on that thread, and I asked what methodology they used to check his body fat levels, and I'll just about guarantee you that they use bioelectrical impedance, which is like just wickedly inaccurate. If you have someone who went in there overweight, fluid retentive because of being overweight, you know, high insulin levels are retaining sodium, they're retaining water, and then you have this huge diuretic effect of paleo diet, and the person comes back in later, the bioelectric impedance stuff is just horribly inaccurate unless you were using some sort of a guide that is standardized in order to calibrate the bioelectric impedance deal. And even then, it's only as good as how it's calibrated to the person that's standing in front of you. If they go eat a really salty meal and come back, then it dramatically changes the readings. And so those things are just horrible. And the thing is that we never see people lose muscle mass on this stuff. I mean, even the basic zone deal, there are some pretty good clinically controlled studies in which people who were sedentary ended up gaining lean body mass, improved bone mineral density, improved muscle mass off of that. And so it's there's some sort of testing error here. I'll guarantee you that. I'll bet money that they use like a electrical impedance gig, and I'll also guarantee you the dude did not lose muscle mass on this.
Yeah, if he lost muscle mass on it, we're on the wrong gig, Rob.
Yeah. That it's just it's heartening to see that they did it though, and then the feedback generally was pretty favorable. It is funny that the most of the comments are very hand-wringing, concerned about calcium, even though every parameter of the dude's life improved, blood lipid parameters, all this stuff, and all these people are just wringing their hands about his calcium levels and gee whiz, what's going to happen to his bones. And then every once in a while, the cholesterol card pops up here and there. So it's pretty funny, even though all that stuff improved. So.
Yeah. And some of the comments are just hysterical. Like, everything's better. I'm no longer lethargic, no cravings, blah, blah, blah. One thing I do miss is a replacement for bread. I'm not sure what I can substitute it with. I miss my bread.
Yeah, I miss it too, but I don't miss being fat and sick. So, you know, it just depends on what you miss more. Your ass fitting in that pair of jeans you want to fit in, or not being sick, or the piece of bread. We've seen people who were really, really sick. The recidivism can be high. You know, our client with the porphyria, where she couldn't go out in the sun, and then she could, and then she slid back into eating the bread midweek and couldn't go back out in the sun again. You know, it's almost like the person who has like emphysema or lung cancer and they're smoking through their trachea. You know, it can be very, very compelling, very addictive for some people.
For sure. All right. Well, with that, Rob, I think we're going to hold the last few for next week.
Cool.
And I think that's it, man. Anything else?
No. Working on the book. We had a couple of days of sun in Chico, so I'm feeling less, you know, the desire to Cobain myself. And although we're supposed to start raining again tomorrow, but I think that'll be good actually for productivity on the book. Just knowing that the sun still exists is pretty helpful.
It will not be good for my productivity, Rob. After working out outside across the San Francisco, and then yesterday squatting outside, I feel like you know, I'm better designed to work out in the sun, and this rain is going to do me in, I think. But
well, maybe under the eave of the awning then.
Just so I feel like I'm outside, but I'm not getting drenched while I squat, although that'd be a good movie scene.
Yeah. Very Rocky-esque.
That's right. All right, well, thank you, sir, and another good episode. We'll talk to you next week.
Cool. Thanks, Andy.
All right, see you, Rob.
Bye.